linked me to this one episode and said something like, oh, you'll really like about this episode 3 minutes in. So I listened to it and the guy called me, oh yeah, Radek, the Swift genius. And I was like, what the f-? This is troubling. My boss is hearing voices. I'm hearing voices too.
Like, I feel younger, you know, and I feel with more power.
Will you indulge a rocket corner for 5 minutes?
Yeah, yeah, why not? Like, you know, go.
If you have to.
Yeah.
All right, so let's continue with the topic from last week. Let's talk some more about deep work because it's a really important topic, right? And this week we'll try to do it right and just jump right into the main topic and leave follow-up, feedback, everything else for the end. Otherwise, we'll spend half the episode on it once again. Sounds good?
And there's the hidden benefit that people can just listen to the, you know, the meat of the show and then just stop listening, you know, when we just stop the
exactly.
main topic. So there's the benefit for you,
right,
dear listener.
So you did finish the book now, I assume.
Yeah, I did. I did finish the book.
All right.
I'm actually finishing another book already. No, I actually finished this book. I finished another one, and then I'm finishing the third now. So yeah, I'm on a roll.
Very impressive. You know, since April. Oh, here we go again. Well, anyway, I'll continue the thought. Since April, I've been pretty much reading a book every week. So yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Well, anyway, same as you. So deep work part two. So one topic that book discussed, which is kind of uncomfortable, I think, to many people, like strange, maybe, I don't know, but something that the book made quite a big deal of and something it made a really compelling argument for is, do you really need social media? I mean, you can tell I spend a lot of time on Twitter, right? But Should I be on Twitter? Do I really need it? Like, why? Like, honest question. Why don't you quit social media? Why do you need Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, whatever? What do you think of that after reading the book?
Yeah, so it just reassured me that that, you know, that we should experiment actually with which kind of social media actually, you know, is good for us and for our purposes and for our goals, that right. We shouldn't be like this, you know, squirrel, you know, thing that we, you know, there's a new social media, let's go, let's jump in, let's, everybody's there, let's go there, you know? Like, for example, on our Nosby reunion,
right,
I was reassured, I don't want to, I mean, I have a Snapchat account, but I'm not using it, and I won't start, because I saw how you're using that and how the rest of my team is using that. I'm actually concerned about it because Snapchat is like this typical, you know, thing that it creates this compulsive, you know, thing of checking it all the time because things will disappear, you know, after a day.
Right.
So you want to check what's up with your friends and you want to be like the completionist of what's happening there because it's going to disappear. So you are going to have the big FOMO, you know, the fear of missing out.
Yes.
And that's why you want to check there. And I was already feeling like this a little bit towards Instagram of really checking all the latest photos of people I'm following because I really like that. Fortunately now, Instagram ruined the user experience because they decided to do the selective, you know, thing that they're not actually showing me all the photos, but only selectively choosing an algorithm to show me some photos. So recently I just decided not to check photos at all because I just didn't like it and I couldn't take it back. And I'm actually not really using Instagram that much anymore. So, but really, I think it was very important that the book raised this question.
Yes.
Because I think we are jumping too much in with 2 feet onto like another social media platform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. There's this phrase thrown in the book, technopoly, and it got me thinking. So technopoly, let me pull the dictionary. So technopoly is a cultural state of mind that assumes technology, and for us, you know, internet in particular, internet stuff, is always good and of value. And that's really interesting, mm-hmm. right? We don't we don't question, like we don't really weigh pros and cons of whether or not we should use Twitter, right? It's sometimes like we kind of assume that everything that's made of technology and enabled by technology, everything that's online is always good, right? And like,
yeah.
Sometimes it feels like with many of these new things, people are like, if you're not using X, what are you, some kind of Luddite? Do you not believe in progress? Why do you live in the past?
Exactly.
Right? And I hope it means something that I'm the guy who's saying it, because like if you know, it's easy for someone who's, you know, 50 or 60 to say that, and it's easy to dismiss that because, oh, you know, they're saying that, whatever, right? But I'm 20 years old, so if I guess if I'm sometimes questioning whether everything that technology is always good for us, then I think there might be something to it, right? Like we have to consider that just because something is cool because it's enabled by high technology, it doesn't mean it's still good for us, or good always, or good for everyone, or good no matter what.
Yeah, totally. And it reminds me, there was an ad, I hope we can find it online on YouTube or something, that like there was this ad that one person was saying to another, where did you find it? On the internet. And this, on the internet. And where did you learn that? On the internet. You know, everything they put on the internet is true.
Right.
And they wouldn't put anything on the internet that wasn't true, right? Of course they would. I mean, this is the internet. It's a digital reflection of our world.
Yes.
You know? And so this kind of thing. And also, I think... also, this idea not only of this technology, but also the fear of missing out that I described before,
totally.
And also the fear of being left out, you know, left out from the society, left out from the cool people, you know, because cool people hang in there, like, you know, the high school syndrome, you know, like you don't want to be with the cool guys, you want to be with the cool bunch, right?
Yes.
So this kind of thing. But I remember, you know, I remember actually. When I was talking to Seth Godin, when I was doing an interview with him for the Proactive magazine, we'll link to it in the show notes, I asked him about his Twitter usage. Why isn't he using Twitter? And he said, you know, Michael, I totally understand Twitter. I totally get why people use it. And I think it's great for many people. And I just want to spend more time creating great content. And I'm doing my blog. Yes. And, you know, I keep publishing every day a blog post. And he is, so you might check it out. He's amazing how prolific he is. And he said that, you know, he wanted to focus his creative juices on creating valuable insight, valuable content. And just Twitter isn't that for him. And the only thing they do, I mean, he does, is that his blog posts are being, you know, tweeted out, like syndicated.
Yeah.
But that's it. You know, he doesn't do anything else. He's not involved in social media. So, you know, it just depends, and we should actually analyze how we use this. And I think he raised a very important point that we should question this.
Yeah, he said something that, like, when you think about it, it sounds so simple, so obvious, it's kind of stupid to even talk about it. But
yeah.
Again, it's one of those things that becomes obvious when pointed out. So he called it the any benefit theory, right? So the idea being, so are you saying that Twitter is useless? And it's like, no. Like, obviously, Twitter or whatever has benefit, right? It's easy to identify the benefit. But like, he really reminded me of something I've been, like, it's a consistent theme throughout our conversations over the last few months. It's something I really had to have hammered in, which is that our time is limited. It's constant. We have 24 hours a day, hopefully 8 of which is spent on sleep, right? It's constant. We can't change it. So everything we do that competes for time is a zero-sum game, okay?
Yeah.
And there's this power law, right? The 80-20 rule, the law of the vital few, whatever you call it. that, yeah, there are things that are, there's a lot of things that have value that are beneficial, right? There's more things we could be doing or that have value than we could possibly do in our lives. But if our but some things are more valuable than others. And if our time is constant, if it's a zero-sum game, and it is, then it doesn't make sense to spend time on the low-impact things, right? It's better to reinvest that time in the stuff that provide 80% of the benefit and 20% of the time. Then you can have, you know, all of the benefit in all of the time when you spend it on the highest impact thing.
Yeah, and just the other day I was doing the presentation on Nosby and the webinar actually, and one of the things I explained was that people have been asking me this, like, Michael, do you want to be a one-person product? You know, because it is so cool to be a serial entrepreneur, you know, to be this guy. I have this business. I'm doing this, that. And I'm just this cool guy who does all of this great stuff. And it is cool. It really sounds sexy, you know. Being a one single product guy, it's boring, you know. It's like, well, we just want to. So you have this Nosby thing, you know, good for you, right?
why can't you be like Elon Musk?
Exactly. Why can't you be like Elon Musk? Elon Musk is so amazing. You know, be like Elon Musk. Thank you very much. I don't want to be like Elon Musk. The thing is that I want to be one product guy. You know, we tried. We talked about it actually on the show. We wanted to have a second product actually.
Episode number three.
You know, we tried. Episode number three, you know. Actually, the podcast, actually, the idea, the first initial idea for me for the podcast was actually to promote a little bit more the other business that we just closed down. So after reading Essentialism, after reading The One Thing, so one of the really cool books that I read last year, and after our discussions here on the show, I realized, yes, it's my conscious choice. I want to be a one-person, you know, product guy, you know? Right. If Nosby is going to be the, you know, the thing I'm going to be doing for the rest of my life, I love doing it, you know? So as long as I'll be loving doing it, and as long as I'll be adding impact and bringing value to people, I want to keep doing that. I don't mind, really.
Yeah, exactly. And again, to loop it back to some of our previous conversations, we talked in Sopot about kind of my realization that, wow, I should spend more time on the good, you know, real work, and less on, you know, the little things that are always constantly there vying for my attention but are low impact. And yes, this is exactly it, right? It's not that they don't have value, because they do. I did them because they had value. It's not like I did something that was
exactly
that was damaging. I did something that was valuable.
You didn't do anything bad.
But it has an opportunity cost, right? Because instead of doing this thing that has some value, you could be doing another thing that has a lot of value. And over the past, you know, few months, few weeks, and with Deep Work, again, all of Deep Work is about that. Shallow work is also valuable. It's just not nearly as valuable as Deep Work. And we tend to spend, you know, 80% of our time on shallow work that provides like 20% of the benefit, and spending 20% of the time on the deep work, which has 80% of the benefit. So why not like resize the balance of the two? You know, let's cut down on the things that are nice to do, but not really necessary, not crucial. Things you can live without, and let's reinvest that time in the things that matter most, right?
I mean, just today I had a presentation at a which was unusual for me at a company, you know, one of the biggest companies here in Poland, and I was talking to the CEO. Actually, he wanted to talk to me, and we discussed you know, working, you know, communicating through tasks actually in his company, and I actually decided to talk to him about the concept from the book, from Deep Work, and told him about the Deep Work, you know, how important it is. I gave him and the board, you know, the idea of this rewiring thing, that, you know, if we practice Deep Work, our brain is, you know, literally being rewired to do the Deep Work. if we just focus on shallow work, we will rewire our brain to actually only to be able to do shallow work. And when I told him, you know, hey, I understand you're the CEO, you must, you know, make all these decisions, you know, you don't have to have so much deep work as the other guys. And he was like, no, Michael, I just analyzed my last month and I realized how many shallow decisions and shallow things I've been doing and how many, I just analyzed that. And no, I also need more deep work. He was like, oh yeah, I recognize that. I mean, I have realized how little of an impact I did over the last month because of the shallow work. And he was explaining to me that he's not like Jack Dorsey. He actually wants more deep work. You know, he's the CEO of a very big, you know, company here, but he still, you know, he craves more deep work. And he told me that, you know, so it's actually a little bit against in the argument in the book that, you know, that the Jack Dorsey's and these, maybe they don't need that much. No, they do, but just they don't do it, you know. And of course, they're successful anyway, for some or the other reason, we don't know. I mean, there are many more, you know, many more things that happen that, you know, that constitute their success, and like Elon Musk and everything. And we also don't know how much time actually they spent on other things, on life and stuff. But he said, you know, and it was a great argument, you know, that he, the CEO of a very big company here, admitted that he wanted more deep work, and then he actually analyzed his last month, and he realized how imbalanced it was with shallow work.
That's very interesting, because we talked about it and it being like, yeah, if you're a CEO, it's a bit different, right?
Yeah.
You might have a different balance of it. Maybe you need less of it. But seriously, he is a CEO of a big company. I just looked it up, and the company you're mentioning, it has on the Polish Stock Exchange, it has a market cap of something like $500 million. So it's not a small company.
Not really. It's slightly bigger than Nosby.
Yeah, slightly. Yeah.
No, exactly. It's a very, very big company. So you see, I mean, even, you know, the CEOs of such, you know, enormous companies, they need that. And, you know, we discussed, you know, Warren Buffett. I mean, he's doing most deep work, and he has so much impact and so much wealth because of that.
Yeah. Yeah, because of that. And so to circle back to social media in particular, like the thing about it, it's not like the author said, oh, you should quit social media, period. It's like, I think his point was more like to shake up and rewire our thinking about it, so that we realize,
right?
that what?
To consider, actually, you know, social.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So that we throw out the end benefit theory, that we realize that it's a zero-sum game over our attention, over our time, and that we should reinvest it in other things. And you should weigh pros and cons. And maybe you should be on social media, maybe on some social media, maybe sometimes, maybe you should change it, right? It's not about, hey, you should quit social media, period. And I'm saying that because I really don't want people to just dismiss it out of hand. Oh, quit social media, that's stupid, right? Because there was a lot of in there to think about. And I actually did make some changes in my use of social media. So I told you many, many episodes ago about how I removed Twitter from my phone.
I remember that, yes.
Because I just realized that any moment, any idle moment of boredom in my life, when I'm, you know, sitting in the elevator or whatever, I would just grab my phone and browse Twitter. And that's a compulsive, unhealthy behavior. And how much really value did I get out of that 10-second Twitter browse? Just about none, right? It was stupid. It didn't really bring me just about any value. It was just a compulsive behavior. So I thought, okay, that's unhealthy. I removed Twitter on my phone. With time, it became hard because I would just, you know, being a junkie, I would just end up accidentally going into Safari and using mobile.twitter.com. I would just still use Twitter on my phone, just somewhere else. And so what I ended up doing is I use one blocker on my iPhone for content blocking, right? And you can add your own filters. So I added a filter that I literally cannot visit twitter.com on my phone. Now, if I really want to, I can do it, right? But the point is, if I really need, like actually need Twitter for some reason, I can get around it, right? I'm not literally locking myself out of it, but I'm putting so much friction into doing that that I won't just do it by accident, you know, out of habit. And I actually now did the same thing on my Mac. I banned all of the social media on my Mac. I don't have any, you know, Twitter or other apps on my Mac, and I also use a content blocker for Safari on my Mac, and I can't visit Twitter.com, I can't visit Facebook.com or Instagram.com or Reddit.com or any of those other things. So now, like, I'm still in those places. I'm still enjoying Twitter for what it is. And it still has benefits for me such that I'm not going to just quit it. Facebook, I don't care about anyway, but there are some like incoming things so that I kind of have to be on Facebook, but I'm not participating anyway. But Twitter is an addiction for me. But for the last week or so, I've been a lot less on Twitter. When I'm on Twitter, I'm enjoying it. But I can only now access Twitter on my iPad. And that like that puts enough friction on me that like it really reinforces the right behaviors. Like my Mac is a work machine. I do work on it. I do productive things on my Mac. I can't by accident go to Twitter.com, and I don't need to, you know, sometimes turn on self-control, which is an app I mentioned some time ago, so that I can't go to Twitter. I just can't go to Twitter by default. If I want to relax, chill out, have some Twitter, have my fix, I go to my iPad and I use my consumption device, my iPad, to do that. And so I end up doing it much less. And when I'm doing it, it's much more conscious that, hey, I'm on my iPad, I'm after work. But when I'm at my work, when I'm on my Mac, I don't do Twitter.
Yeah, I applaud that. I mean, really fantastic that you're doing that, that you're limiting yourself. I on the other hand, I'm monitoring my Twitter usage now more. I actually, I'm still having my Twitter on my iPhone. I don't go to Twitter actually on my computer at all, but on my iPhone, yes. And but now I'm trying to reinforce creative work on my iPhone. So I redesigned a little bit the icons, I mean, the placement of icons of the apps on my iPhone to be able to be more creative on the iPhone, to use these blocks of time when I'm just, I have a few more minutes, instead of, you know, getting my fix, getting, you know, some information from Twitter, I actually go and write something, you know, jot down an information. And actually, very often when I walk, I'm listening to audiobooks recently very often. So what happens is that I use the Evernote to and I have the note from the book I'm listening, you know, as a shortcut. I just add notes, yes. You know. And one of my recent discoveries was that actually I can dictate notes, because the dictation works a little better now on iPhone 6S. And I think it's also because the iOS 9. So I actually dictate notes. So it's really it's really interesting. I'm actually using that more often. So I'm trying to, you know, consciously convert my usage of my phone into more of a creative device than a consumption device. And I'm designing, you know, the placement of icons and on apps in such a way that actually it encourages creating stuff than just browsing stuff.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I think maybe you still should reconsider having Twitter on your phone. But still, the good thing is that I think you're now more conscious of the whole issue. And so you can observe yourself and your behavior and see if it's useful and how often do you, you know, engage in the compulsive behavior with Twitter on your phone. And if you're more conscious about it, if you realize that this might be a problem, that it's a zero-sum game, then you're more likely to tweak it in response to, you know, to your behavior.
Yeah, totally. And also, I, for example, redesigned my usage of Facebook and LinkedIn. I don't have any push notifications from these services. I still use them, but I check them actually after my weekly review. So every week I check them just to also clean out the inbox. You know, the, I guess, as a kind of thing, you know, just to clean out, you know, all the invitations that are coming and all the comments that are coming, just to see what's there. But I'm using less Facebook now as I than before, and I'm actually, you know, considering actually removing Instagram from my iPhone because they ruined it. They ruined the experience. So I don't feel I get so much value out of it anymore, you know. And the photos are nice and stuff, but really, do I need these photos? And, you know, and I started using more Instagram because I like taking pictures. But then again, I don't know. It's just, again, this is the thing. It's quite okay. It's a nice thing to do and nice thing to browse some pictures. But again, is it really great? Is it really something that I really get lots of value from and I give lots of value to others? I don't think so.
Yeah, exactly. For me, it was like, I like the pictures, but I like posting pictures. But with time, kind of the enthusiasm died down. It's like, yeah, it kind of felt like another thing I kind of have to do. And it's like, I don't do that much anymore. And the photos, you know, it's nice to browse them. But again, the parallel, right? Mm-hmm. It's not that, oh, you should be productive and working for your entire life. Like, it's not that. You know, Instagram is nice. It's entertaining. But there are things that are more nice and entertaining than browsing Twitter. Instead of browsing Twitter or Instagram, or Facebook, you know what's a better form of entertainment? Actually hanging out with your friends in person. Yeah. Or even, I don't know, instead of having your Twitter fix for 5 minutes, mm-hmm. 10 times a day, maybe you watch a movie or whatever. It's not that, you know, you have to be disciplined and perfect and working all the time. It's like, even when we talk about non-productivity, about relaxation, about entertainment, it still applies that you have, you know, some time and attention you devote to that, and some activities are better at it, have more benefit. So why, you know, waste time on the low benefit activities?
There was a book by Michael Bungay-Stanier a few years back. It was called Do Great Work, and or Do More Great Work. And it was again, he was like kind of reinforcing the same idea that we're talking about right now with deep work, is that good work is that. It's just that, good work. But shouldn't we be focusing on actually doing great work, something really fantastic, where we actually bring lots of value to people? And as you said, you know, figure out the 20% where we get the 20% of effort, where we get 80% of reward, and double down on the 20%.
Right. And, you know, sometimes you can't or you don't want to eliminate those, you know, those 20% benefit activities altogether. And you don't have to, right? But just changing the balance and just realizing that there exists this parallel, this 80-20 rule and the zero-sum game is enough to make a difference in your thinking and your behavior and hopefully ultimately your results.
Yeah, so just question this, you know, and I think that was the good point of the author of the book, you know, question this, try it, see what sticks and see what's really, you know, what's really important to you, and figure this out, you know, yourself. And I'm glad that we changed a little bit our behaviors because of this book.
Yeah, me too. So we're 30 minutes in and I have a sense like this book, I don't know about you, but it gave me so many things to think about and so many like other starting points. So it mentioned this book called 4 Disciplines of Execution, which I heard about before from you, I think. Mm-hmm. But it made a deep work made a compelling pitch for that book. So
yeah,
this is what I'm listening to right now. And so I feel like we'll be talking about ideas from it for a long time.
Yeah, totally. The 4DX book is really, really good. I was surprised how good it was, and how great of an impact it did on me. And I'm still using content of this book to this day.
All right, great. I think we should do a weekly weigh-in. because you need to be held accountable.
Yeah, I do need that. Yeah, so I'm good. It's better. The 70 thing was a fluke. I'm between 67 and a half and 68 and a half. Like on the whole week, I was like that, like in this range. I don't know. It depends on what I was eating or maybe what I was exercising. I don't know, but it was just like bouncing between these numbers all the time. So I'm
67 and a half and 68 and a half, right?
Yeah, that's my situation right now.
Okay, so that's between 149 and 151 pounds for the Americans.
Right.
I would prefer an average. It's easy to say, you know, between, but the average tells more.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Well, so next week I'll bring in the average then.
Well, on my front, despite traveling last week and eating a lot of really great food, last week's average was at 70.2 kilograms. So it's really good. And I'm now confident that I can keep it. It's just, it's easy. It's simple. It never was, and now it is. So the kind of structural changes in how I eat and not just punishing myself made a big difference, and I think now it's good. Also, I did this thing which I had at the gym. They kind of advertised doing this kind of body composition analysis things, so that, you know, they tell you how much you know, how much fat, how much muscle, how much bone mass you have. So I did that, and it's good. It's really good. I wish I did that, you know, half a year ago or a few months ago, so that I had a comparison point. But like pretty much all of the measurements are like in the middle of the correct range. So that's really nice. That's something I would expect. In fact, with my body fat, I was measured, and you know, it's a bit of an estimate, I guess, but I was measured to be at 8.8 kilograms of fat that day, and the kind of normal range starting at 8.9 kilograms. So I was actually at, and in fact, slightly below a small amount below the correct range, which is just a new thing. it's not something that happened before.
Nice, congrats. I mean, as I told you, my scale tells me a different story for some reason. I have two scales. I mean, one in my house and one in my parents' house, and they give me totally different values. So I might go see a professional about really actually giving the real value there. But for me, it's a benchmark. So yeah. Nice. That's really good.
All right. So that's cool. Like in fact, the only thing the trainer has recommended is, ideally, I should have like 3 kilograms more muscle mass, and that would be like just perfect. It's not like required. The number is okay. It's in like definitely healthy range.
Okay.
Not in any there's no threat there, but like do that and it would be like just perfect. So that's very interesting for me, because like it was never close to the ideal numbers.
Oh, it's really good. It's great to hear, because I mean, the moment I changed my diet like 2 years ago and I became the person I am now, I feel just so much better, and it's just so much comfortable, and like I feel younger, you know, and I feel with more power, and this also enabled me to do sports on a better, like on a more frequent basis, and I would recommend everyone to try it. And I hear so many people asking me about the diet, and you know, we became already, you know, the experts on this. And there was this story that we discussed before the show, that you know, somebody actually discovered us and Nosby because they were looking for slow carb diet information on the internet, and they found my articles on my blog about it. But but this is crazy stuff. But if you think about it, yeah, if like, the more people would try this and realize how much, I mean, that this is all possible, that we can all do it. I mean, you know, I remember you, you remember me, like we were chubbier. We remember each other, yeah. Like that. We are no longer these people. So it's great.
Chubby Mike.
Chubby Radek.
All right. Will you indulge a rocket corner for 5 minutes?
Yeah, yeah, why not? Like, you know, go.
If you have to.
Yeah.
All right, I'll send you a link and I'll put it in the show notes. It's in The Verge. That there are some photos of the recently landed SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket. So I briefly mentioned it, I think, last week. Was it last week? Probably last week.
Yeah, last week, yeah.
Yeah, so last week, SpaceX had a third successful landing, the second successful barge landing, and the first successful landing from a geostationary transfer orbit mission. So the photos, they're just amazing. Like, you have this hangar, this big hangar, with 5 huge rockets, and they're all like covered in soot and like all dirty, but they came back and safely landed propulsively, and that's just amazing. That never happened. So that's very cool. And the newest landed stage, I mean, you can see it really took a beating. It's still like functionally, it's probably just fine. It was like complete, right? But it was coming down at a much, much faster speed because of the higher orbit. And if I remember the number correctly, it was experiencing like 16 times the heat of re-entry because of the higher velocity as it was, punching through the atmosphere. And you can see like on the interstage, it's like, it has these like scorch marks, and at the bottom, where you have the engines, there are 9 engines, and each of which has a kind of an isolated engine bay, and there are these access doors that are missing. Right, there must have been some kind of overpressure event because the extreme conditions that blew out the access door, which is the correct behavior, but it really shows that it was a hard, really hard landing, and it worked.
Yeah, it's amazing how the rocket looks like now.
Yeah, and something interesting that that Elon Musk now said is that this newly landed rocket will be a live leader for ground tests, and what it means is they probably won't see much of such hard comebacks. Like the missions in the future, they will be less hard, and so they're more likely to just land more softly, right? And so this is likely to be the most beat up landed Falcon 9 in quite a while. And so the idea is they will really stress test it, you know, put it on a test stand. Fire the engines, just try a lot of things, stress the rocket. And the idea is, if after all of this and these stress tests, it's still good, then you have like a much higher degree of confidence that if this worked like that, the other landed rockets, which didn't experience such extreme conditions, are pretty likely to be, good. And safe and reliable.
Yeah, let's see about that, because the rocket really, like, it looks like it's been through things. It's been through the hell and back.
yeah, that's very interesting. And you know, it's interesting how SpaceX is all about low cost. The low cost doesn't normally get people excited, but this is low cost through really high tech, right? And through recovery, which is high tech, And SpaceX rockets are pretty much cheaper already than anything else without the recovery. But the interesting thing now is that because of landing, like even if they couldn't recover them, couldn't relaunch them for whatever reason, they wouldn't be just low cost, but they have the opportunity to be the highest reliability launch provider, because no one else can see their rockets after they're launched. They're like launch once and they're gone. They send some data over the air that sensors picked up, but you can't test it after it landed. You can't fire it again. You can't see into the structure of the metal to see how much fatigue it had to withstand, right? Like no one has the access of intact rockets after they launched. So they don't have this amazing, you know, treasure trove of data to use in further development.
Yeah, I mean, this is, and if you think about it, really, something that is right now, as we discussed before, like we take for granted that the planes don't, you know, disassemble themselves when they land, and we can use them again and again. And like, for example, like the Southwest Airlines or Ryanair here in Europe, there are these airlines that just let the plane rest for like, I don't know, half an hour, maybe 40 minutes, just to, you know, just kick people out and put new people in and just go back to flying. And this will be the future of space. I mean, the space will be very similar in the future. Not yet, not in 1 year or 2 years, but this is going to be the future, that the rocket will come back and they will just need a few minutes or hours or whatever to, you know, to put more stuff into it, and then we just go back. So yeah, is coming. This is inevitable.
Yeah, and the plane comparison is actually really good, because rockets might do more extreme things, but look, rockets are like what, 100 million? A Falcon 9 is 60 million. Some rockets are 400 million. You know, big rockets anyway. Mm-hmm. But so are planes.
Yeah,
I think a 737, a new one, is again something like $100 million. A brand new Airbus A380 is something like $400 million. So those are similar prices, actually, but because they can reuse it so much again and again and again and again, the enormous cost of the initial hardware is just amortized so much that it doesn't matter. So one last thought, if you can indulge me any longer.
All right.
They actually attempted something they didn't talk about, but Elon Musk confirmed it in a tweet. So you know how when you have a rocket, right? You have a rocket, you have your first stage, second stage, and then you have this fairing, right? So this nice kind of bullet-shaped box in which a satellite sits, right?
Yeah.
And those are just like two pieces made of, you know, some composite material or whatever. So those are, you know, at just about the same time the second stage separates and the first stage now goes to land, the fairing also separates. And the fairing is lost. It just, you know, gets disintegrated in the atmosphere maybe, or hits the ocean and then gets destroyed. But the thing is, even though it looks like a dumb piece of equipment, it's actually not that cheap, because it's big. For a Falcon 9, the fairing is like 5 meters in diameter, almost 15 meters in length. It could fit an entire like school bus inside. So it's really big. And even though it doesn't have a lot of like smarts in it, because it's so big and it has this carbon fiber composite aluminium honeycomb structure, it costs like $2 million to make. So that's not cheap. And so they've been trying to recover that too. Because the thing is, it's lightweight, right? It has the shape such that if they could orient it the right way towards the atmosphere, it could slow down such that it could deploy a parafoil, and then maybe it could land softly enough on the ocean, it could be recovered, or maybe even caught mid-air with a helicopter. So they've been trying to do even that, because once first stage recovery is done, then like everything else will start to really matter, right? The next steps to reusability and lower cost. So that didn't quite work, but Elon Musk said they're progressing and they think a solution is possible. So that would be interesting to have the first stage retrieved, the fairing retrieved, when they launch a Dragon capsule instead of a satellite and a fairing, they're recovering that. So the only thing not recovered for now would be the second stage, which is just a small rocket, a really small rocket compared to the first stage.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, it's interesting when this all starts to make sense and just work and be almost totally recovered. That's what really really something. But we are not far away from that, so we'll see. But they're making progress on that.